I'm Richard Porter.
I'm Johnny Smith.
And this is Smith & Sniff, a podcast in which two friends talk about cars and answer some more of your questions. All right then, more questions.
Questions. Things about questions.
Where do we leave this? The next question, we're just doing this all in order. Next question is from Alex Montgomery. On which cars have you found your views least aligned with the journo consensus, either terrible cars being quite good or hero cars actually being a bit meh?
There are a few. I blooming can't remember them.
The one that I always didn't quite get, and some journalists seem to think was brilliant, was the Civic Type R, the sort of bread van shape.
Oh, the first Civic Type R, early 2000s.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the first sort of official UK one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that I was on Max Power when that one was launched. So we had a glut of them. The Honda was just kind of throwing them at us like cracker gifts. I have to the thing about that car is I still think it looks awful.
Yeah.
And I know it's considered a modern classic.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. It's very, very highly revered amongst Japanese performance aficionados. The engine is fascinating. It's just that in the same... Well, okay, you weren't enamoured by that. I'm gonna get told off. I've already said in the past there are key elements of the MX-5 I'm not down with. The S2000... There's many things to like about it. I just don't really like the engine.
Really?
Yeah, and do you know why? It's because I realised I get annoyed with cars with no torque.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because I just don't see... What, if you could choose torque or no torque but revs till 11,000 RPM, why would you choose the latter? I don't understand.
I don't mind if it revs to 11,000, but I'd like some torque.
It doesn't
I know what you mean.
The
S2000 felt like it had... almost no torque whatsoever.
It has no torque at all. You have to like drive it two gears lower than what you would drive a car with torque in. And I just got a bit fed up with it. And I know
what were the numbers on that car? Is it like 240 horsepower? It was probably like 105 pound foot of torque or something.
Yeah, but I mean,
yes, I know what you mean. It does make a car feel sort of wispy somehow, doesn't it? Like it hasn't. Conversely, you know, a very torquey car feels sort of meaty somehow, yeah. But the best cars, you know, combine some elements of the two. So
yeah, they do,
and reviness with a bit of grunt.
There's always a couple of cars also, if we only get to drive them for, I don't know, let's say a morning, you can't fully explore it. And I always try and say that in reviews, you can't discover everything you like and dislike about a car in three or 4 hours of driving. And sometimes the bad things soften and they become less annoying with time. Likewise, the things that you like about the car initially could wear off very, very swiftly. So
yeah, I mean, what I would say, I think, is that when you do car reviewing for a living or part of your living, you do get quite good at assessing a car quickly, don't you? You can get a feel for what's good and bad about it quite
yeah, I think so.
Soon after setting off. I mean,
seat of your pants vibe, and you get
and you sort of you know what to look for, and it's, you know, and it's not a science, is it? I mean, you know, when all's said and done, most car reviewing is really entertainment. There's an element of consumer journalism where you are trying to help people who might seriously be going to buy one of these things, but ultimately they'll probably go to What Car or Which magazine or something if they're going to be that sensible and read up everything. A lot of what we do in reviewing cars is you're just trying to amuse people and then leave them with a definite sense of whether it's good or not if they were going to buy one. So there's that thing about knowing when a car's good or not. Is that, was it Lotus people always had that sort of, a car had to feel good within 20 feet or something? Or was it Ford originally said that?
Ford.
Faults.
Do you know what I have to say? The first Focus RS was really not down with it. I got into it and I thought the interior was hilariously offensive.
With, I was like, what,
how could you possibly make the blue so bright versus black? You know, that's like, that's a no-no. That's a complete no-no.
From memory, didn't it have a starter button when no other Focus at that point did? And it felt really sort of aftermarket as well. Like yeah, they'd just gone down to Halfords for it.
You couldn't, from memory, you couldn't quite see it from the driver's seat. It was between that, it was either behind the handbrake or in front of the handbrake. And it was, I mean, I jumped in it from another car when we were on a like a massive team test thing. And no one told me where the starter was. And everybody else drove off. And I was there for about 2 minutes just going, it can't be that hard. There's nowhere to put the key. I don't understand.
Is that like when I was on an Evo group test and I got into McGann R26R? I think it was the one with harnesses rather than belts.
What a car.
And I was still talking to someone. Oh, my God, what a car. But I was still talking to someone as I was putting the harness on. And then everyone went, right, let's go. And they all jumped into cars. And I was like, okay, yeah, go. And started it. Went to close the door. And, of course, couldn't reach the still-open door because I was now harnessed into the car.
Yes.
And had to undo the fucking harness again because everybody else was driving off. We sort of go, sorry, can someone close that? Oh, never mind, I'll do it
myself. The key is to do the fast acceleration to shut the door. I've been in race cars where you can't do it any other way. You're fully strapped
in.
Yeah,
but I couldn't because we were in a car park and I had to back out of a space to do it. There are other cars where I was like, I'm not going to risk that one.
Oh.
Ripping the door off by mistake.
Well, what about this one? This is a good question. I'll skip over the one. Does Richard regret buying the Range Rover yet? Because I just doubted it before we recorded this.
No, it's running well. I'm just going to jinx it. I know, but no, it's great. Great family car.
Sweet family car.
Sweet,
lovely,
sweet car.
Lovely for
likes
urban
to
use.
Drink.
Jamie Webb, both of you've been on Sam Moore's Car Chat podcast, where he asks the questions: What one car would you have with an unlimited budget, with a £500 shed on the side? I'm more interested in what your shed would be on the side and rather than your dream car and why you wouldn't just go for a Mark 1 Focus. Well, we've talked about Mark 1 Foci before. They're a fine car.
I sent you that one last week. I don't know if it's still
you
there.
Did,
it
you did.
On Car and Classic. There was a really tidy 1.6 LX, which I think might even be sort of sweet spot. I know the Z-Tech was probably a little bit sportier to drive, but the LX probably rode better from memory, and that 1.6 engine was all right. It was a perfectly good engine. It had just enough grunt, and it was only had 17,000 miles on it.
Wow.
It was up for like £1,400 or something, so it's, yeah, I had a brief moment. I just went, I could just buy that. Why not just buy that? And I was like, I
feel like as we slightly get older, a clean Mark 1 Focus will suddenly jump from £600 to £6,000. Won't notice. I think my kind of £500 sort of like ghetto resistant kind of cockroach car, and it's not the first time I mentioned it, it's a K11 Micra's got to be up there, possibly a K12. I do very much like a neat bubble Micra.
They're a bit rotty, aren't they? But if you could find a really lovely sort of, you know, elderly,
well, a lot of dead people have them.
One.
Yeah,
yeah.
They are a very good low mileage deceased spec that you see for sale.
Yeah, annoyingly, because that Mark 1 Focus, the super tidy low mileage one, is out of budget. I can't have that. So I think £500 shed on the side. I'd go Mark 1 Yaris, which we've discussed before as a cockroach car. And they're all over the place. I just see them around. And I'm slightly fascinated by them. So tidy one of those again.
Yeah,
you
right.
Know, deceased. Manual 1.3.
Deceased spec, yeah.
Deceased spec. Yeah, don't want an auto. I want the manual, though. But 1.3, the 1 litre's too slow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd do me.
Christopher Howelski, if you could add one rule to make Formula One more competitive and exciting, what would it be? I'd love to hear your answer to this.
I don't know. What about the one rule is no rules?
Oh, my gosh. Have you been watching Greece, where they do the street race in the gully?
Yeah. No rules, but I mean, obviously there's rules about for safety, I suppose. But what I mean is no technical rules, except that everything has to be mechanical. So you can't have any fancy electronics that would do active suspension and stuff like that, because that probably would just make the cars extremely fast and quite hard to overtake. But if you want to have a flat 12, if you want to have seven Wankel rotary engines strapped together, if you want gas turbine, you can do that. And I don't know whether, in fact, everyone would alight on the same solution.
I love that.
Or if it would lead to lots of really interesting randomness and things catching fire all the time. I really don't know, but I'd like to see. Because I think
it's all well
and good. Formula One has to try and show itself to be more sustainable and more in tune with the world that we live in now. But it's so token. You know, the most environmentally sound thing for them to do would be just stop. Driving around in circles and travelling the world is not ecologically inclined. So
just stop
why
it.
Not just give up this pretense? Just go, look, it's only a small number of people doing a small number of this every year. It's entertainment. Can we just, all bets are off, we're not going to do hybrids. We're not, unless you want to. You could do a hybrid if you think so. I'll allow electric motors in there for fun. I just don't want, you know, electric driver aids.
I think during this, I'd suggest, sorry, you said driver aids. I just said, right, pit stop. I'd say during the pit stop, the driver has to play a musical instrument. and the other thing, because obviously you need entertainment here, and I would say the second one would be, we totally abandon the idea of expensive groundbreaking slick tyres. It has to be 70 quid a corner, road legal rubber. You can put whatever engine, you can put whatever drivetrain you want in it, but if you can't get round a corner on 70 quid a corner road legal rubber, then you're losing. I'd love to see what happened.
Yeah. So there have been F1 drivers who have actually been quite musically proficient.
Yeah, I bet they have. But imagine old Romain Grosjean going in on the mandolin, it go flailing the ukulele. Someone, the car goes in, the jacks go up. Someone
They got to be good at it.
It's got to be a recognisable as a song. You could do a very, very quick arpeggio. I'd probably let that off. Imagine Lewis Hamilton's so like down with the kids. He'd probably do a keytar. He'd do an amazing keytar song.
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't he?
Would you extend as far as that maybe he could have a couple of decks that would sort of swing in on a carbon fibre arm and he could do a little bit of mixing and stuff? just spin some really sick beats for the duration of the pit stop. Because there's a great skill in mixing two records together.
Just take a big slug of coffee as you suggested that, and it was that was very difficult for a second.
There is a recent Formula One driver who was a sort of concert standard pianist. I think
James Toseland. James Toseland, the motorcycle world superbike rider and GP rider, he's a proficient pianist, isn't he?
Is he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. And he has his own band now. And he's married to Katie Mellower. Not that that makes him a good musician.
Is he?
He is, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, so he had a massive argument with her about the 5 million bicycles in Beijing, because he's like, well, just, I'm not interested in bicycles, I'm more interested in motorbikes. Yeah. So how many motorbikes are there? I don't know.
I didn't bother to check.
Right, that's
why am
it.
I married to you?
Damn you! But no, James Toseland. He's he's an amazing pianist, and had a bad crash, and I think had to kind of retrain the dexterity in one of his hands, cause playing piano. Okay, well, I can't wait to see your idea of Formula One now.
I'd willingly add your rule in there as well to mine. There are no rules except you have to play a musical instrument during pit stop. What? They can have rocket engines, yes, but I have to play a small Casio keyboard during the pit stop. Yes, left, please.
Yes, please. It has to be.
That's
half
it. Decent. Every race, the authorities, me or you, gets to choose which tunes they have to play.
Oh, so there's a song of the race.
Yeah.
So 2 days before,
maybe, or a playlist.
Do you go
maybe a playlist.
2 days before, and you go, right, that's it. Everyone's going to play Country House by Blur. Okay, off you go.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's how it could work. Well, you know, we'll work through this a bit more once Liberty call us and give us the okay.
Liberty! George Wade, if you had to pick an estate or to daily drive, what would it be and why? Has to have five doors, can't be a combi or a shooting brake. I thought we'd answer. Did we answer that question? We had one about.
No, remember we.
Oh, it was about a British car, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, it was. It was. We were helping someone's dad with car suggestions,
oh, that's
and we
right.
ended up on an E63 estate. I think
that's right.
Which actually would be quite a good one. I'd pick that. Or I think there was recently up for sale, possibly on Clicton Cars, a Jaguar XFRS.
I was just about to say that, you absolute goon.
What a lovely car.
Yeah, the blue XFRS. Mm. I have seen a black one about, and it does look hard, really hard. Yeah. That would be, for a piston estate, that would be very good. There aren't many... Well, there aren't any. Oh, there's an MG electric car estate, and
there is the MG5 EV.
Yeah, and you can commission a Tesla Model S estate if you want to, which looks quite cool. Actually, I've driven that. So I would consider that if I wanted to do some, you know, EV estate work. Yeah, there we go. Can't be a shooting brake, I'm afraid.
No, shame. Well, I mean, but everyone's calling, you know, Mercedes CLS shooting brake, which isn't a shooting brake, it's an estate, and we had one of those, and that was a lovely car.
That's
maybe
true.
AMG, one of those, would be quite a nice choice. Anyway, we better move on. Tim Organo. Sorry, Tim, I was about to call you Tim Oregano. I misread your name. Tim Organo, have you ever driven or reviewed a car, either press car or max powered, that you liked at the time, but now look back on and think it was really shit?
That's a good question.
It's usually the other way around. The stuff that you drove at the time you think it was shit, and now you look back at it and go, actually, maybe it was all right. I don't.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
I don't know. Every day that goes by, I get more and more agin the current Mercedes G-Wagon, and we drove it for a Smith & Sniff video, didn't we? And I didn't hate it at all. It's quite impressive in a stupid sort of way.
Yeah.
But there's something about it that sticks in my craw. I think it's that sense that Mercedes could do better, in as much as they've sort of deliberately made some parts of it feel odd, or, you know, like even the fact you have to really slam the doors. That's not how you have to close the doors in any other Mercedes. They've done that because old G-Wagons feel like that, so they've done it deliberately. Sort of go, Merck's not that kind of company. They're very forward-looking normally, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it's just also it attracts twats.
It's the fake the fake roof gutters are a little bit
exactly
annoying.
It's fake. There's fakery in
it's just cladding. It's just it's UPVC cladding.
Yeah,
I have driven some max powered cars which were just appalling. I just had to state fact in those. Look, this is a car with nitrous and a carbon fibre dashboard. And I just had to tread carefully.
Really solemnly state fact.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah. Next question.
Peter Agius? Agius? Sorry, Peter, I'm
Agius?
Mangling your... Agius. A-G-I-U-S. Agius.
That sounds like a new Hyundai model.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Some kind of rebrand for a previously well-known... Postal delivery service or something. No, we're not the post office anymore. We're Agius. Anyway, Peter says, hi, guys. For those of us not from the UK, brackets Aussie here, can you produce a badly animated / live action skit of
Sporta Guy.
A day in the life of, etc., with stereotypical fashion in their daily driven vehicle. We need to get the vibe fully. Cheers.
Peter, welcome. Welcome.
Welcome.
Sporta Guy, he's... Well, Spoltz. He's a hardworking person.
Yeah,
and he's one of those people that definitely he enjoys his downtime. He's got best clothes. He's got his best car,
downtime, I think. Golf.
Yeah,
and goes down to Portugal or Spain to play golf. Yeah, yeah.
Lots of sun. Him and his missus love the sun. So when he's not doing the plumbing and all that, and also has an immaculate work van, one of those unnecessarily over embellished work vans, which do trouble me. Where
or a pickup?
Yeah, maybe. You know, like where you think, well, hang on, this is a utility van. It's supposed to get stuff thrown in it, and it's supposed to be put up with a lifetime of abuse. You've bought it with body coloured everything, lowered 30 profile tires on a van. What?
Yeah, but it's because he's the boss, isn't it?
He's the boss.
He's got staff.
And it's
he's
Spoltz.
Got employees. The company's doing well in whatever it is. It's sort of building trade or property maintenance or something like that. And he's the boss, so he doesn't actually have to get his hands slash van's truck dirty the way he used to.
Yeah.
I think that's why you go for the fancy body colour bit, because you can.
Sports
it's
guy,
almost a way of showing.
He's quite fit. As in, but he might just do weights rather than any core. You know those guys that've got big arms,
but really skinny legs,
but still got a pot belly. Yeah, so you're like, well, look, yeah. Clearly you like the arm work. That's great.
But you also like beer.
Yes, we also like.
I mean, you know, it's a gauntlet we all like as middle-aged men. But
it so is.
When you see someone who embraces it, just goes, yeah,
Spoltz. But Spoltz guy also, he loves to proclaim about the fact whenever he orders a new car, he just ticks every option box. Oh, it's got everything. It's got everything. I didn't order anything.
I said to Michelle, only the best. Only the best for you, my love. So I've ordered every option.
I want it all.
On the Range Rover Spoltz.
All of it. Spoltz. But even if someone goes, oh, but like a couple of those options aren't very good and they're just seemingly overpriced, doesn't matter, I got it anyway.
I told him I want it all. Yeah, it's sort of, I reckon, by the accent, I think probably London-born, but has moved out, a bit more space, nicer house, and so probably Essex, but also could be. There's a sitcom, actually,
Hearts.
That touches on a bit of this sort of sport guy.
Sport?
King Gary, have you ever seen it?
Yeah.
The comedian Tom Davis.
Tom Davis lives in the same town as me.
Does he?
Tom Davis lives up here.
Does he?
Yeah, he
I
does.
I never knew that.
Yeah, huh. I've bumped in. I mean, I don't know him. He doesn't. I don't know. He didn't know who I am. But I've walked past him three times, and we sat near him in Pizza Express.
Ah.
And we got to the point where it's like he totally lives here, and a few people have gone, oh yeah, he lives here. So he does. He lives here, which surprises me.
Yeah,
it's quite far
from
north
sort
for
him. Of Croydon way, isn't
I think
it? Where King Gary's set.
South London, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's that. That's the thing. I just assume when I started watching it, it was in Essex. And then something, I kind of went, oh, wait, I think it is. There's sort of other pockets of outer London / home counties.
That's right.
Where people who've, you know, done all that might sort of gravitate towards.
I like him because he was a prisoner in Paddington 2, the film, and he had one of the funniest one-liners, which I thought we always quote it in our house, where he talks about is it a raspberry panna cotta with an apricot glaze, and he says it really aggressively, and it's just the way he delivers the line is just brilliant. I don't know, I just love it. He grits his teeth.
I've not seen that film, but I'm laughing already.
Paddington 2 is better than Paddington 1. It's one of those
I
films.
Have heard, yeah, and I regret that I haven't ever watched it.
I'll watch it this weekend. Go wild.
We've got sidetracked. I was going to say, Peter, if you can in Australia, find a way to have a look at the British sitcom King Gary, which you should do anyway because it's very good. There is quite a sort of sport. In fact, his dad, played by Simon Day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's proper old school sports.
He's proper old school sports.
He'll wear the white crisp socks, which just say sport on them. we still don't know what sport they're tailored for.
Yeah, just general.
Just sports.
Snooker.
Snooker
next
socks.
Question. Nadim Rahim says, right, let's get to the real question. Who would be quicker around a lap at Dunsfold, Chops or Mrs. Porter?
Well, that's a hell of a question.
He's asking who has a faster wife.
Who has a faster... I don't really know what your wife drives like.
She's not quite steady, my wife. When I first met her, one of the things that attracted me to her, not primary things, but something that sort of went in the plus column.
The only thing that attracted me to her was...
I didn't see her drive for quite a while, but then when I did, I was like, oh, you know, she's a good, competent driver. Like, she you know, she knew what she was doing. And but that was in the US. And mm-hmm. I think... she, you know, she was well equipped to drive on the mean but ultimately quite straight streets of Los Angeles. And I think she became a bit more cautious when she moved to this country. But she's a pretty steady driver. She's a good driver, but she's not like, you know, speed demon. I've never driven in the car with your wife though, so I don't know what she's like.
My wife's good. She's a good driver, and I'd
yeah,
say
I had a feeling
she. I think she can press on. The kids. I remember coming back about 3 years ago when we had a Mercedes estate, plug-in hybrid as a family car on lease, the kids came back one day and went, "Dad, you're never going to believe it, Daddy. Mummy hit some ice on the back lanes and like we went completely sideways." and Chops just went, "Well, I just went around a corner and it was sheet ice. I didn't realise, and just had to kind of turn into the skid." Both the kids were like, "Oh yeah, we went fully sideways. We were drifting, Daddy. We were drifting." But she was totally cool about it. So I thought, I think she could be quite quick on off of a track. Yeah.
Now, the only thing is, my wife, my wife's never driven on a track. I don't think she has. She's been in cars on tracks, but only as a passenger. Actually, that's not true. She has. She's driven around the Barcelona Formula One circuit, but in like a people carrier that she was driving.
Is a Suzuki Wagon-R.
I don't think that counts because she wasn't going for a fast lap. The thing about my wife, though, is she's very competitive. So I think it could get interesting on that score, but she'd need a bit of time, a bit of track time to get her eye in. So I don't know. My feeling is it might be your wife, but I wouldn't discount my wife's competitiveness.
I suppose we just have to be big up our wives, don't we? So
yeah,
both our wives would be really good at it. They'd rise to the challenge. I bet Chops is quicker than me. I've never gone down that rocky road of being completely outgunned on a track. Okay. Sander Hopp, has Stellantis asked you guys to run their marketing department? I feel like their branding could use some more Euro dance.
Still waiting for that call.
Yeah. I'm still waiting for the jacket.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting.
T-shirt. Did you get a t-shirt though?
No, I never did. I want a silky bomber. I do want a Technic style silky bomber jacket with Stellantis embroidered into it, cuz I think it would be hilarious, especially if the Stellantis letters get bigger towards the ends. You know, a bit like the Thunderbirds logo. I think that could work really, really well. Stellantis should just do an annual rave, but a Euro one. It would have to be in the Algarve or somewhere like that. And it'd be free for everyone in the locale. And it just turns into, 50,000 strong, happy Euro rave. I was thinking the other day, in the car brand Infinity.
Yeah.
There's someone that does takeaway deliveries around here in an Infiniti.
Really?
Yeah, it just looks like they've nicked their grandparents' car. But in fact, they probably have. But I always thought Guru Josh, his only hit was Infiniti, wasn't it?
Mm.
The late Guru Josh. I feel like if they'd use that track and that uplifting track in some of their commercials, that could have just raised the bar for the excitement. Or possible excitement around an Infiniti car. It could have been good, couldn't it?
I can only ever think of that track with him looning around with a keyboard and then the refrain, 1990s, time for the Guru.
Exactly.
Which
it was 1990s.
They'd have to take that bit off for the Infiniti advert.
They'd have to bleep that out.
Yeah.
Bleep it out.
Next question, Adam McConkie, will you go back to doing videos? Yeah, we answered that one in the last show, didn't we? But Adam also asks, have you ever reviewed something and a press officer taken it badly, then they call you up all a bit angry?
Yes, I just can't remember, but yes, they have.
I gave a stinky review to the Mini Paceman.
Oh yeah,
because I thought it was shit, and I think I said that some bits of the design seemed to be almost spitefully shit. And I didn't get the call, but shortly afterwards I had to ring up and ask to borrow another BMW Group product. And there was a bit of a grown-up conversation about, well, now look, the last time we lent you a car, you said it was shit. So see it from our point of view. We're a bit. But then I had to be grown-up as well. And I went, so are you saying that you will not lend me any more cars because I reviewed one of your cars poorly? And they went, oh, no, we'd never say that. And at that point,
week on Tuesday then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. The car industry is quite grown up in that it will take criticism on the chin. You know, I've heard about sort of like tech companies. You say that their new phone or TV or something's no good and that's it. You never get invited to review or given one of their products to test ever again. And car companies generally are a bit more sort of broad shoulders.
Yeah, they are actually. In fact, there's one manufacturer who I've if I've been less than kind about elements of the car, I don't think I've ever panned completely one of their cars, but they've often called me up the week after and said, I know that you don't like X and Y about the car, so why don't you drive this version of it? And they tackle it in a very different way. Instead of getting bolshy about it, they go, okay, we get that, you don't like that. And then they ask for almost constructive criticism, or they say, try a couple of the other versions to see if it softens your hatred.
Yeah, that's like when I reviewed the current Jaguar XF and they lent me a base model, and it was just, yeah, you know, it just didn't feel very, very, very notable in any way. And I said so, and the Jaguar Land Rover PR boss's response was, well, you didn't like that one. Maybe you'll like an XJR. Shall we send one over? And which we did a video in fact. And that was the way that he dealt with that, which was sort of mild criticism. It wasn't like going, it's an absolute crock of shite. I just said I didn't particularly care for it because it was ordinary. And yeah, his response was, all right, we'll borrow one of... And I think it's his way of also sort of subtly going, yeah, we know it's a bit average here. Borrow one of our cars that's not average and that'll take the taste away.
That works.
As long as they don't feel like you're being sort of needlessly or unfairly rude about cars, then I think most car PRs in my experience are, you know, pretty grown up about it, and everybody can be friends, because also a lot of car PRs are into cars.
Yeah, they are actually. Yeah.
Deep down, when one of their products isn't very good, they know.
They do, don't they?
So they can't get cross with you because they know that. And sometimes a lot of them are ex-journos, so there's a kind of going, well, you know, once upon a time, that would have been me having to review this crock of shite. Anyway. Yeah.
Toyota Urban Cruiser.
Yeah. I can't remember this joke. But at the time, I remember they announced that car. I wrote a joke for Top Gear. I can't remember who used it. It said that Urban Cruiser just like sounds like someone who's not allowed within 20 yards of a playground, which I'm sure would have gone down very well.
Oh, gosh.
Next question, Ben Young. Which car manufacturer merch would you personally endorse? One, Koenigsegg's large organic farm fresh eggs. Two, British Leyland Polo Neck sweaters in Austin Allegro colours. That's a good idea.
That is a really good idea.
Three, yeah. Lancia smartphones that they actually made themselves and not rebadged off an OEM. Oh my God.
That's
four,
good.
Honda Type R talcum powder. Or five, Seat sausages, brackets, which will actually be rebadged VW sausages.
Rebadged sausages.
I know which one you're
really
going
good.
For.
Do you know what? If the Koenigsegg organic farm fresh eggs, if they all had Christian's face drawn on them, then I would definitely. They have a personalised stamp, so all of them look like Christian when you open the box.
Christian's Koenigseggs. That's amazing.
Yeah, Koenigseggs. I think that would be fantastic. The same guys put, this is really tickled by ribs. It has us too. How about an Urban Outfitter / Stellantis collab clothing accessories range? Well, I mean, we've just kind of mentioned it, but definitely.
Yeah.
I'd have a Stellantis bum bag.
Yeah.
100%.
Ben's joke.
What about
Ben's
those Gap Year bracelets?
Polestar times Under Armour gym gear collab would be a really effective one.
Yeah, oh, yes.
Well.
Under Armour.
But to answer your original question, Ben, I'm all in with the British Leyland Polo Neck sweaters in Austin Allegro colours.
Yeah.
The Lancia smartphone.
That is quite good, actually. Type R talc. I can imagine that just being out of control. I mean, what?
Very high revving talc.
Yeah, would it be ultra fine?
Yeah, you have
or would it
to
come
use
out
a lot
way
of it.
Too quick? You expect to dab a bit on, and it comes out like a huge puffball, fills the whole room. You've got to fumigate the house afterwards.
Does anyone under the age of 80 use talc?
No, I can't imagine it's good for your lungs either. I bet it's really bad, like asbestos.
Yeah, I bet it is, isn't it? What is it anyway? Yeah. I don't even know what talc actually is, but
I don't know what talc is. We'll have to investigate on another episode of Smith and Sniff what talc is. Okay. That I answered that question on the Patreon. Does Johnny particularly insure all his vehicles individually? Yes, I do. I insure all my cars on separate policies. I don't have a multi-car policy because although it's less paperwork, you don't get agreed value, and I'm a big fan of agreed value, so I genuinely insure all my vehicles individually. It's a lot of paperwork. I set aside 2 days for it a year. Obviously, we all love cars. This is by Brett Rowley. Obviously, we all love cars, but are there any two-wheelers that you find especially interesting or enjoyable? And what is your earliest memory of a car, playing with a toy, riding in one, or seeing one? Well, I like a lot of motorbikes. I mean, I do have a license, as I've said before. I just don't ride very frequently. I've always had a penchant for bikes that fit in cars, like compact bikes, like Corgi para bikes, Honda Monkeys, that's Honda Moto Compos, that sort of weirdness. And there are a couple of really cool ones like that. But I do also like, my brother's always been into British motorbikes. So when I was growing up, he would always be buying British bikes, and he persuaded me to buy a BSA Bantam when I was 14. a trials bike. He did. And I kept it for a couple of years, and I realised my heart wasn't actually in it, so I sold it and then put the money towards buying my first car. But I've always fancied, there are a couple of British bikes. Sunbeam S7 is I think, a gorgeous British bike. Shaft drive, huge balloon tyres. It looks good. It looks like a sort of British Indian, if there was such a thing. And also the Royal Enfield, the Indian Royal Enfield bikes. When I was in India about 3 years ago on a job, I realised they are such a cultural icon there. And like, the true man about town rides around on a... There was what beautiful, like, murdered out and a couple of olive drab highlights on a Royal Enfield, and it looked great. 500 twin, sounded amazing. He was like, it's an Indian Harley, really.
Tasteful. I've seen a video of the guy in the Royal Enfield factory who puts a pinstripe on the fuel tanks, and he does it by hand, and it's absolutely like as straight and accurate extraordinary skill.
I think they're a cool bike, and they're not that expensive from what I can see. So,
are they actually sort of nice to ride, or are they kind of like a bit of a throwback now? I don't know anything about bikes, really.
They are a bit of a throwback, but they're not one of those bikes you buy just for the style. They don't ride appallingly. Mm. They kind of are what they are. I guess it's the charm of, let's say, like your Defender and our Jimny.
Yeah.
It's that kind of... There's a mix of old and new, and... It's probably just about right to give it character and flaws that you forgive.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, I would actually have one. I would actually have a half decent one.
I don't know anything about bikes, but I do find them interesting, like as in the engineering and stuff, I think, because when I was working in the office with James May and Richard Hammond more regularly, they were forever turning out with some new bike, and I'd quite like to go and have a look at them. But then they'd start talking in that kind of biker language that I just don't understand, with lots of letters and numbers and references to things I didn't get. But yeah, I find them quite interesting. I don't have a bike license, and I've never ridden anything more than a scooter. I'm too much of a coward. I tell you what I find interesting, those Triumph Rocket 3s, because they look mad to me. And I heard one once. I was walking down the street, and there was this extraordinary noise from behind me, and I turned around, and it was one of those. Made the most... Incredible.
It's a 2 litre, I think, or
it's
a
2.3, I think, isn't it?
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
is it?
It's proper nuts.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Triumph doing great things. I wish I was more into bikes than I am old American cars, because from a storage perspective, one of them is far cheaper and easier. I got a garden shed, and I could fit probably four motorbikes comfortably in there, whereas... For American cars, it's an industrial unit that costs you thousands a month.
And there's so much performance for so relatively little money from bikes. I'm always staggered when it's like even something quite exotic like some kind of Ducati is sort of the price of a Fiesta, if that.
Yeah. And bikes, have become like horses, they've become a leisure pursuit more than ever, haven't they, rather than... a cheaper alternative to cars.
Yes.
Well, I would like to ride a Honda Gold. I might do a video one day of riding a Honda Goldwing for the first time. I've never ridden one. I'd quite like to. I might dress up as Prince from Purple Rain.
Oh, could you just do that anyway? I'm not really that bothered about the Goldwing. Well, I am, because I find those interesting as well, but I just want you to dress as Prince from Purple Rain for a bit. Say a year. what, I'm going to dress up as Prince for a year?
Yeah,
for a year. You know, the famous car journalist LJK Setright?
Yeah.
He famously used to just sort of decide to get into a look and then embrace that look. So in his later years, you know, he used to sort of dress like a rabbi. And apparently, previous to that, although he was Jewish, he wasn't particularly devout. But he suddenly sort of found his faith and then decided he'd go all in on the clothes. And before that, in the 70s, he spent a period of time where he just used to wear tennis whites.
I heard about this.
Yeah, it's true.
So non-tennis playing tennis. So, okay, I mean, no one's asked this question and we probably should move on a bit. But yeah, if you could wear clothes from a sporting pursuit, that would be an interesting one. What would you rock and why?
I mean, for sort of general all-purposeness, I'd probably just go snooker because I don't white.
Snooker?
White is really impractical. You just, as soon as you put,
you
go,
have
I'm going
to
dress
a
like a cricketer.
Waistcoat.
I know, but what? Well, what are
like
you going to do?
Like a Betfred waistcoat.
Well, I don't. I mean, you're going to say, I don't know, windsurfing.
Oh,
you've got
gosh.
To walk around in a wetsuit the whole time. You're going to look like a tit.
No, I'd walk around. I'd be like a park ranger. But not like one from Yogi Bear, Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
Park Ranger's like not a sport.
Oh, yeah. It's a pursuit, though. or is
it's
it?
A job.
Okay, it's a job. I'd walk round as... Oh, I know. I'd walk round as a modern-day lumberjack, because modern-day lumberjacks...
Lumberjacking's not a sport either. That's a job.
Okay.
You're just listing
I'm
jobs.
I'm not quite understanding the question.
It's your question, you twat.
What an absolute wand. Wand of plenty.
I actually, do you know that guy...
I dress up as Bono. Is that a sport?
The sport
I dress up
of
as
being Bono,
Bono and just shout one love at everybody wherever I went.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And on New Year's Day, I'd run around shouting New Year's Day as Bono. And on Sunday, I'd shout Bloody Sunday around the whole village dressed as Bono.
Do you watch Line of Duty? Because the guy...
No, I've never seen it.
The guy in that... One of the detectives in that does actually dress quite like he's playing snooker. He's way ahead of you.
Really?
Yeah, pick a sport and dress like that forever. He's already done it. So, just thought I'd mention that. We should go back to the questions which we were answering. Brett asks, what's your earliest memory of a car? I don't know. I feel like it's sitting in the back of my mum's Mini, like old school Mini.
It's going to be, isn't it? It's going to be sitting in the back of mum and dad, sitting in the back of my mum and dad's car with the tartan rug to stop your legs from getting burnt on the black vinyl.
Yeah.
I think I can remember the smell of my auntie and uncle's car because it was always immaculate, like really immaculate. And it always felt special to sit in it because everything was just so, and it was a much newer car than ours, so it was always quite cool. And also going to primary school, my parents used to alternate lifts with a couple of other families.
Yeah.
So I used to go in a Fiat 127, an early chrome bumper Fiat 127, which was rotten, and a Mark 1 Escort Estate, which is obviously two-door estate, totally impractical, but they look good. And I remember those being quite... like jolly events because no seat belts and just lots of vinyl and axle tramp from the so I think those and I do remember turning up at the primary school outside on the side of the road, and I can still remember what everybody drove. I can still remember the cars that they pulled up in, what colors they were, why they were, why they appealed to me, why did they catch my eye. I still remember all that. Hillman Imps, SD1s.
Are you sure you can remember the colours, though? Only because I had to go back into my archive of Evo magazines to look something up the other day. And I was specifically looking for a Lotus Elise that I drove on a Car of the Year test about 15 years ago, which in my head was blue. And I was looking for it. I finally found it, and it wasn't. It was grey. And... if you'd have held a gun to me, I'd have gone, yeah, it was blue Elise we drove there, yeah, in Wales, yeah, definitely. And it's just like, I don't know why, but in my mind's eye, and I could even picture one of the photos in the magazine, which I was imagining correctly, except for the colour of the car. And it's bizarre how your mind plays tricks, I think. Like, the memory of colour is a bit movable.
Maybe all the colours I've remembered are wrong. I mean, I am a little colourblind, so they probably are wrong anyway.
All right. Stephen Cooper asks, when I bought my Skoda, brackets Rapid, diesel, possibly an oxymoron, but it was cheap, so I can't complain. I noticed one of the options set on the computer was to monitor oil temperature. Now, in the history of motoring, has anyone other than those that race cars ever given a toss about oil temperature? And could this be a feature for Richard's next book? Utterly pointless toss that OEMs add to cars as the feature list on the base model was looking a bit shit. I don't agree with this, Stephen. I like to know oil temperature. It doesn't matter what car it is. I want to know oil temperature because your engine isn't properly warmed up until your oil temp's there. Everyone goes off the coolant temperature, but coolant warms up quite quickly. Oil takes a while. And
this is true.
My 911 has a proper oil temp gauge just bang slap there on the dash.
Yeah. There is that. I mean, if you haven't got an oil temp gauge, you always would look at the coolant temperature to get an idea of warmth getting into the engine.
But anyone who's got a car that has oil and coolant temperature will know that the coolant hits temperature way before the oil. Oil takes a lot longer.
It does.
Wasn't it some BMW M cars where they had the same dial layout as the sort of normal 3 Series or 5 Series, but the coolant temp in lesser cars was replaced with an oil temp, so they didn't have coolant temp, they only had oil, I think.
I know that they obviously restricted the RPM, didn't they, limit when cold start and cold use. I don't know. Well, all I know is with an air-cooled car like my old Beetle, what I would used to do is I'd always set the heating on immediately. And I'd drive off down the road, and typically about 4 miles in, I'd start getting heat out, and then I knew there was some warmth in the engine, so you could probably be a bit more aggressive. Not massively scientific, but you know, it's just that mechanical sympathy just creeping in there.
Yeah. Matt Tester asks, now that it's April and it's snowing, what's your choice of relatively cheap roof-off shitter? I had a smart roadster for a couple of years and actually missed freezing my nips off in it. I refused to drive with the roof closed unless it was actually raining. MR2 205 Cabrio Pluriel? Personally, I'd like an X19 to go back to the classic equivalent roadster.
I phoned my mum and dad at the weekend, and my dad had just been out in the Golf Cabrio, so it was sunny but really cold. But he enjoys that, and I like that he enjoys that.
Heater on, heated seats if you've got them on, and you get that fantastic sort of baked Alaska effect where your arse and feet are hopefully hot, but your head is...
But you have nature's own Botox, where your face gets so cold that you can't. you can't actually change your facial expression.
If you were an actor in Hollywood and you didn't want to go down the Botox route, I suppose it's too warm in California to get away.
Sadly,
with just drive to every event in cool air with the roof off a cabrio, and your face will tighten up nicely.
Yeah, you would. Or just a car with fly screens as opposed to a full windscreen.
Here's Robert Downey Jr. arriving at the premiere in his smart crossblade.
Yeah. I met someone with a smart crossblade.
Did they have a very tight, fly-splattered face?
He was very jolly, though. I feel like maybe he's got a little bit more oxygen in his lungs than others. So maybe he's loving life a bit more.
I'm loving it.
I like smart roadsters, and I've never owned one, and I will own one because it's on my list of things I ought to buy. With
now,
those
funnily enough,
dish steelies.
Yeah, my mate Paul across the road here has just bought one. And I've got a little pang of jealousy because I had a Brabus one as a long-termer from Evo years ago. And I loved it. I mean, it was, you know, in so many ways, it was a very flawed car, an incredibly hard ride. And
they leak, apparently.
They leak. Well, so Paul's bought this one, and I was looking at it, and I was like, it's got a sort of extra cover on it. It's got this like tight fabric thing that covers the roof, but then it's anchored. It stretches backwards. Like a sort of, you imagine how the roof on a Boxster Spider is, where it's got these sort of spars of fabric that go back.
Like a bikini top, yeah.
This is the hatchback roadster that my mates bought.
Which is the good one.
Yeah, definitely the good one. But this fabric, sort of two spars of fabric stretch back along the side windows and are anchored somehow. around the back lights. And it's a thing that the previous owner put on to stop it leaking.
Yeah, that's. I was going to say, that's totally aftermarket. It's so that the seats don't smell like a dog basket in winter.
Yeah, yeah. But they are, there's something very likely about them. And if they have the fabric roof rather than the two lift-out panels, you can just whiz that roof back at any speed. So it's like suddenly, you know, I'd be just like driving through central London and suddenly go, actually, do you know, it's probably quite warm out, isn't it? I'll just whiz the roof back. It's great.
Yeah, it's true. Actually, you know what? And also, while we're talking about it, a smart convertible, a smart 4.2 convertible is quite cool. I quite like those. I mean, they're not sporty, but good cabrio experience.
Mm. Yeah. Matt's also mentioned the MR2. Mark III MR2. I've got a bit of a thing for those. I think they're really nice. No boot, obviously, but that's, you know. Actually, there is a bit of a boot.
Well, you have that, and I'll have a Daihatsu Copen, because I've always thought they're cool. So, and no one agrees with me. So let's draw a line under that.
All right. Next question. Quentin James. Richard, what do you really think about Jonathan Palmer?
Go on, say it.
Next question, Martin Wasty. Hi, guys. Can you tell us what you really think about influencers? I mean, I know a lot of people sort of in our business, car journalists particularly, get a bit bent out of shape about them.
Yeah.
And I always think, it's not for me to criticise in that it's obviously they're doing something right, because the successful ones are very successful in terms of the amount of eyeballs that they get onto their videos and stuff. And so it's my opinion is irrelevant. It's not for me. I don't particularly enjoy a lot of the content that I've seen from a lot of influencers, but that's because I'm obviously not target market, but whoever the target market is enjoys it. So they're doing something right.
I think we're not the right demographic for some of them. I think there's denominations of influencer. I think that you can't tar them all with the same brush, because there's ones that are probably going into a little bit more detail, and there's ones that are only really appealing to school kids. And I watch what my son watches on YouTube, which is just a lot of gamers.
Yeah, mine too.
With headgear on, telling you how to build the perfect house and sword on Minecraft.
Yeah.
And to me, I mean, it wrecks my head. I'm like, why are you watching someone playing a game? I understand that gaming's fun, but watching someone gaming, it's like, that's like me watching someone brush their teeth. I don't quite understand why that's cool. But again, it's totally different generation.
They drive me to distraction. I mean, I would happily flay some of those lot with wet rope, because my boy just watched them as well. It's the shouting.
Just very shouty. It's the shoutiness. It's like, you can be talented without just being shouty. Please, try it.
The thing that I do get annoyed with the car influencers that I've watched who do that sort of quite superficial approach is they're sort of proud of their lack of knowledge, and I feel like that actually is nothing to be proud of. It's like you've chosen to stand up there and speak about something, but it's absolutely hollow if you haven't even done some basic looking up of information. You know, to know inherently very much about the subject matter. It seems odd that you would choose to broadcast this, but again, I sort of feel like I'm being a bit old fashioned there. And you know, there are some of what you would term influencers who do know their stuff. I mean, there's that guy, Mr. JWW, who has obviously decided to sort of go down a kind of editorial route and actually think more like an old school magazine or broadcaster. And I suppose you'd say the same about people like Shmi, even, who I know gets a lot of flack, but he's made a great success of it. And he's not a sort of classic kind of youthful icon, is he? He sort of is just this kind of bloke in comfy sweaters, and he's not what you would imagine to be a highly successful influencer to look like, but he's doing something right. So,
well, he gets the access. He obviously can buy the cars, and he also gets access to certain cars, and possibly is the hardest working person in this industry. So,
yeah, that's the other thing.
On that basis, although a lot of his videos aren't for me, doesn't mean to say that I don't respect him. And actually, I know him, and he's a really nice guy.
Oh, do you?
Yeah,
I didn't realise that.
Really, any time I send him a message, I get one straight back. I've just dropped something. I just dropped something off my desk. I was gesticulating wildly. Apologise for that.
My my respect for him went up massively when I saw him diving into a Piston Heads thread about influencers and answering people's questions and responding to their criticism, but doing it always in a totally sort of even-handed, very respectful way. He didn't lose his shit. Some people were being quite, you know, pointed about some things, and he didn't rise to it. He just gave very factual answers, and I thought, fair play, because that takes some doing.
Actually,
the temptation just to go, oh, fuck off, you piece of shit. I've got a fucking Ford GT and you haven't. It would be so immense. And he didn't do that. He was just absolutely, you know, completely dignified and grown up. And I thought, fair play.
I think he must be very level-headed. He must be.
There is only one influencer whose videos are appalling and who I've met, and he's a twat, but I won't say who it is. People can just have a guess, but it's definitely not Shmi.
Yeah, I've met one that was an absolute rod bolt. Yeah. Like, honestly.
Martin also asks, who are the motoring journalists, past or present, that you most admire? Golly, there's quite a few. I mean, but some of them I now know and would consider friends, and it's a bit weird.
Yeah,
some people I grew up reading. I mean, Clarkson being one of them, but also Richard Bremner being another.
Yeah.
Who I, you know, are now mates. And so I wouldn't, not that they listen to this, I'm sure, but I would.
Dickie Meaden.
Them. Yeah, Meaden.
Very, very good.
John Barker.
John Barker, Steve Legend. Sutcliffe.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Not Peter Sutcliffe.
Not Peter Sutcliffe. No, John Barker, actually, I would give special mention to, because he's one hell of a driver, but he's also, I used to sub-edit stuff for Evo, so I would see people's words in the raw as they came in when they handed their homework in. And all the people on Evo are good writers, but Barker's copy used to come in and it was immaculate. Like, you just didn't have to do anything to it. As long as it fitted on the page, it was like, you know, grammatically, it was all just there. It made sense. It was, you just didn't have to do any tweaking unless you needed to make it fit for length. And he drives in the same way, super precise. It's just, it's a joy to be in the car with him, because you always feel totally in control, but he's also on the absolute limit of what a car can do.
Yeah. And his dream car is a flawless Capri.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that it's just nice to know that these people are humans after all.
Yeah. And then the other journal I'd just chuck in there is Russell Bulgin, which I know a lot of people always cite. I think he was an absolutely fantastic writer and quite an innovative writer, because he wouldn't just trot out the usual cliches, which I think too many car journalists still do. He always came up with a different angle and a different way of approaching stuff, and he's just a beautiful writer. So, there's a long
story. Still a lot of good writers out there. A lot.
Yeah, there are. There are still, I think it's, you know, it's a great skill to be able to sort of capture how a mechanical object feels and put it into context and communicate that well. And thankfully, there are still people out there who can do that.
Jason Barlow, you know, Jason Barlow.
Jason's a good writer, like that, yeah.
Who obviously I used to work with on Car.
Yeah.
And his writing ability is incredible. Really, really good. And I know he loves it. And that shines through in everything that he writes about. So, yeah. And he was 50 last week. So happy 50th birthday, Jason Barlow.
Oh, yes, he was, wasn't he? Not
that many people that I share texts with about Huey Lewis and the News and other 80s bands that not many people talk about.
I'm feeling guilty now that we've not name-checked somebody else who's really good. There are loads of really good ones. I mean, I think that's the thing. I always say, when people go, how do you become a car journalist? And I always go, well, you've got to like writing. You've got to be interested in writing.
And they're all, they're all better.
There's loads of people who know
Tom
about
Ford.
Cars.
I think Tom Ford's a fantastic writer. I was always very envious of how well he could put out a decently crafted feature, like how prolific he was. He could do 2,000 to 3,000 fantastic words in the time it would take me to do 400.
Yeah, Jeremy's like that. He's the fastest writer I've ever met. It's infuriating, because you just go, oh, you've done it. Oh, and it's good.
I have to be locked in a cupboard to do that.
Yeah, I know. It's just like...
Genuinely. I think that is the cupboard locking is the only trick.
Let's move on to another question. Chris Rayner, I think it was Richard who mentioned a recently kindled interest in pre-war cars. No, it was the other one, Chris. You said, didn't you, that you were becoming a bit more interested because of your brother.
Yeah, I think it was. It's a combination of my brother and the fact. I think as I get older, you realised how much innovation and design and style in the automotive world has come and gone. Mm. And you before, I never really looked at cars kind of pre-1950, and now I'm looking further back. There's some great books, obviously, but you also, it's when someone like my brother, who reads up on these things anyway, he will point out amazing pieces of engineering on a car, even a car that's dog ugly and perhaps massively unsuccessful, but he'll go, yeah, the thing about this car is it had that. And he would just point at one aspect, and that one aspect is what makes it shine.
Interesting.
And I love that. Love that about it. Love that about it. Oh, yeah, bastard.
Thanks to James Baker, who actually replied to Chris's comment and said, I think it may have been Smith, just because his brother is a pre-war car mechanic. James Baker gets one of our Listening Carefully awards. Next question is Martin Stevenson, who says, have you still got fizzy yoghurt on your topic list? Yes, I have. I'm not deleting it until I've worked it out, and I haven't. Martin goes on to say, the reason I ask is I bought a lunch over Easter while out and about and got a small pot of melon. I left it on the car seat all afternoon in full sun. When I finally opened it early evening, fizzy melon. So...
fizzy melon.
Live in session tonight. It's fizzy melon.
It's definitely the start of the decomposition, isn't it? Very early stages of decomposition.
But then also probably the basis of, I mean, there's a bit of fizz has to go on in the making of like bread and beer and stuff, isn't it? Yeast is all about, I think, fizz. I'm probably talking shit there. I don't know. A couple of weeks ago, whenever it was, or last week, the show when we were talking about flying ants and flying ant day, and then for the show notes that I put out for Patreons, I looked up flying ant day, and it turns out there's no such thing. You were actually right about temperature and humidity dictate when the flying ants start to come out, but they don't just pick a day. It's a period.
Ants don't have calendars, you complete flesh one.
Well, as far as you know, they don't. I mean, these days they probably just have a calendar on their phone. But anyway, there we go.
Yeah. Google Calendar.
We probably should start to wrap this up. I'm just going to spool down and find one more.
There's so many questions.
Thanks
to everyone that's fired a question at us. Thank all the Patreons who've done that. I really appreciate that.
Noel Huggett is a regular correspondent and avid listener, so I think we owe it to Noel to do one of his questions. He's actually started his post here as, oh my god, so many questions. What plans have you got for future Smith Stiff videos? We sort of covered that in the last one. K cars are massive in Japan. I've just watched a YouTube video on K campers. 30 minutes of my life I won't get back. Would the both of you spend a night in one, and where?
Oh, after being at home for the last year, even if it meant possibly sleeping in the same ultra slim cake car bed as you.
Can we not have one each?
Yeah, we can, but we could pull an all-nighter and just drink some sake.
absolutely.
And just talk.
Absolutely ripped on sake. Fall asleep in a tiny, tiny camper van. You can get two people in them, presumably.
Yeah, I think you can. It's like a Citroen C15. I mean, although that is not a K car, but I think there's two beds in those.
As to where, I don't know. I just the coast. I want to go and see the sea and... You know,
yeah, that's a good one. Should we go to a downtrodden coastline?
Yeah, we could go downtrodden, couldn't we? Or just rugged and remote.
I'd quite like to go to Kent. I've not been to Kent in about 7 years.
Kent cams?
Yeah, let's just go cam hunting.
Cam, all your cam needs are Kent cams.
I'd be really pissed off if Kent cams have relocated to the bloody Middlesex.
We tell you what Caterham did, didn't it? Yeah, we're called Caterham because we're based in Caterham. Well, we used to be. We're not there now, so sorry for your wasted trip to Caterham looking for us. Right, well, we should probably stop this. We have still loads of questions, but I don't know what to say. We'll come back to them maybe at some point, or we'll just have to say, if you haven't had your question done, unfortunately, you missed out. You have to get in early.
Do you know what we'll do? We'll use them as sources of inspiration for the next couple of Smith and Sniffs, I reckon.
That's a good idea.
So we can get the ball. We'll use it as an icebreaker for the chats.
Yeah. Well, anyway, but thank you to everyone who sent questions in, because there were so many that we've got this bonus show out of them as well, which we didn't expect to have to do. But it's also because we talk too much, I suppose. But thank you for the questions, which were very good. And we will do this again soon. Maybe we'll just do a sort of reset, and we'll do another whole show or shows dedicated to questions. But in the meantime, thank you ever so much for everyone.
I'm just scrolling through them. There are some brilliant ones.
There are. And thank you, because all those questions came from our Patreons. And so if you are one of those people, thank you for chucking in a few quid to support this show. A man called Tim Schroll, by the way, has emailed in, not through the Patreon, but he sent to smithandsniff@gmail.com. Say, chaps, I hate being the one who points out bad things about something, but I feel like I should. Your supporters on Patreon are called patrons, not Patreons. It literally says it on your page. And he sent a screen grab, and he's right. So, yes, duly corrected, Tim. Thank you to all our patrons. And we will see you again on Monday for a regular episode of Smith and Sniff. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
It is patrons, isn't it?
Yeah,
it
is.
Sounds like a concept car.
patrons.
Yeah, the patron.
The patron. The Citroën patron.